Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk. Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Listeners of Sons of Patriarchy, Peter Bell here, producer of the podcast. Just so you know, we are turning ads on for this series, and the reason is simple. We need to cover our costs. It takes a lot of money to run this, as everything has been self-funded up to this point. We ran this past the Sons of Patriarchy team, as well as the survivor community, and we have received the green light to act on this decision. These ads will not be intrusive, nor will they be random. They will occur at the beginning and end of each episode. There will be no interruptions during the content of each. With this decision, we are earmarking 25% of the revenue these ads generate towards outreach, which exclusively provides resources for survivors of the movements we are exposing and profiling. The rest will go to cover our costs and our time in producing this series. If you would like to donate directly to our efforts, find the outreach link in the show notes. There you can give a single or recurring donation. Along with this, we are turning on Apple subscriptions. $4.99 per month will give you access to ad-free listening. You can also sign up for the same on our Patreon account, link in the show notes. Now, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to Sons of Patriarchy. Before we dive into today's episode, we want to take a moment to provide a content warning. In this episode, we'll be discussing sensitive topics, including emotional, spiritual, and sexual abuse. We understand that these subjects can be triggering for many listeners. If you find yourself feeling uncomfortable or need to take a break, please feel free to pause or skip to a later segment. Your well-being is our top priority. We encourage you to reach out for support if you need it. There are resources available to help you through difficult times. These can be found in our show notes and intake form to private support communities, which are screened. Thank you for being here with us today. We begin with When Vice Broke the Dam, Abuse in the CREC, Part 1. Our Thursday episodes will be a bit different than Mondays. In these, we will be platforming the women, and some men, who have suffered horrific abuse at the hands of the movement we are profiling on Mondays. I will be providing very little commentary between interviews. I want the stories to be louder than I am. There will be no music or sound mixing throughout our Thursday episodes because we want the stories to speak loud and clear. In this episode, I'm joined by Sarah Steinkorb, the author of the 2021 Vice article, Inside the Church That Preaches Wives and to Be Led with a Firm Hand, and the 2023 book, Disobedient Women. Before we begin, I'd like to read an excerpt from the Vice article that broke the floodgates open. Then, Sarah will introduce herself. From Steinkorb's Inside the Church That Preaches Wives Need to Be Led with a Firm Hand. Depending upon whom you ask, Moscow, Idaho either hosts a Calvinist utopia or a patriarchal cult in which women must submit or face discipline at home and at church. Cigar puffing and presenting like a Christian philosopher king on YouTube videos, Pastor Doug Wilson is a radical provocateur, even among outspoken Christian conservatives, and appears to relish Twitter wars and blog battles. In the 1970s, he became pastor of Christ Church, which is now influential within the Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches, a denomination Wilson helped found that includes more than 100 churches nationally. In 2003, 94 ecclesiastical charges were brought against Wilson by his denomination from improperly using church funds to pay off students' casino debts to carnal threatening of others. But the charges were ultimately dropped. In his book, Father Hunger, the pastor writes that a lack of fatherly authority in biblical masculinity, one that does not simper and lisp, is a root of various modern failings, including the poison of egalitarianism between genders. He has written, the sexual act cannot be made into an egalitarian pleasuring party. Instead, he argues that a man penetrates, conquers, colonizes plants, while a woman receives, surrenders, accepts, and that true authority and true submission are therefore an erotic necessity. The idea is pervasive. In Wilson's wife Nancy's book, The Fruit of Her Hands, she describes wives as lovely, enclosed gardens cultivated for marital sex. But of course, a husband is never trespassing in his own garden. In consequence of Wilson's theology, women told Stan Korb for the Vice article about how Wilson sided with abusers in court cases, how teachers at the school Logos, founded by Wilson, behaved inappropriately. Students were questioned by Wilson and his wife Nancy about sexual activity under the auspices of ensuring they were remaining pure. Women could be disciplined by the church for leaving childcare or food prep up to their husband. A woman at a church influenced by Wilson was cast as dangerous and cut off from friends for raising concerns about Wilson's blog. There was failure to report inappropriate sexual behavior, a father watching his daughter shower, to the authorities. And women who understood wives could not tell their husbands no to sex, in one case resisting, in another dissociating, they lived with sexual assaults. From the article. In Federal Husband, Doug Wilson asserts men must assume full spiritual responsibility for the household, including any wifely negligence to submit in spending habits, television viewing habits, weight, rejection of his leadership, laziness in cleaning the house, lack of responsiveness to sexual advances. Such a husband must confess failure in leading his wife, outline clear expectations, and repeatedly point out her failures. As she complies, he must move up a step, requiring another of her duties to be done. If she continues to rebel, it's appropriate to call in the church elders. Many of the emotional dynamics ex-members describe in the church run parallel to coercive control and abusive relationships, while theological demands for submission normalize the same pattern at home. Church leaders, doubling as counselors, know how to hurt rebellious members. Elsewhere in the article, Stankov writes, "A culture that normalizes sexual abuse and harassing survivors is just one manifestation of the authority and control that blends devotion to God with submission to church leaders." For years, Christian blogs have detailed sometimes anonymous accounts of Christchurch's spiritual abuse, a phenomenon typically defined as faith leaders creating a toxic culture within a church or community and using their position to shame and control. As Wilson has built out the church's holdings, he has protected his empire through theology that demands submission and church discipline, and for those who do not comply, excommunication and occasional online bullying. For Kirkers, speaking up takes courage. And before you hear from Sarah, she wanted me to let our listeners know that she has spasmodic dysphonia, which makes her sound nervous, but she's not. So let's listen to her.
Hi, I am Sarah Stankorb. I'm a religion reporter. I also cover politics and gender. My book is called Disobedient Women, but I learned about Moscow a few years before writing the book through some research I was doing while reporting a story for Vice magazine. I'll say I have covered many people who've dealt with abuse or harm within a religious setting, but the Moscow sources are front of mind for me, even after all these years, more than most. What they've been through, the lingering fear that a lot of these people have, it stays with me. Frankly, many of these people find it difficult to trust after what they've experienced. And I think now that they do trust me, they like to give me updates and make sure I've seen what is currently going on.
So how does someone like Sarah become interested in Doug Wilson? Let's ask her.
Oh, it was purely by accident. I was chasing a completely different story. And at the end of the interview, as one does, I said, is there anything else I should know? This woman I was interviewing had been part of the classical Christian education system herself. And she knew a young man who lives in Moscow who was very distressed that day. And I think the emotional situation he was in had been kicked off by this tiny YouTube podcast that was led by a pastor and for which a woman named Sarah Bader had given a couple of very frank interviews. And once I started looking into Wilson and the claims she was making on this podcast and the various cases, legal cases that the Wilsons have been involved with or weighed in on, that the church had been privy to, and the members of the congregation had been involved with, this story just spooled out in front of me. And I actually put the first story on pause to follow this one, and then spent a lot of time really focused on trying to understand Moscow.
Who knows what would have happened had Stan Korb not stumbled over the story. Though abuse stories had been circulating since 2015, they hadn't found a wider general audience until Stan Korb profiled Christchurch and Doug Wilson. With all the church abuse scandals that have come to light over the past decade or so, why focus on this small community and a seemingly fringe pastor and church?
I mean, there's a lot that can be said about church abuse and cover-up and struggles within churches. But one of the pieces that does not get maybe as much introspection is the ability of someone like Wilson to act in a therapeutic role, both within the church and within the school logos. I have had sources tell me that as students, Nancy and Doug Wilson asked questions about their sexual activity, expecting detailed answers. Wilson has defended this, saying it's his responsibilities as an educator. For example, you would not blame a gynecologist for asking questions about your sexuality, as if those roles are equivalent. Wilson is, of course, not a gynecologist. So on one side, you have reports of the Wilsons asking inappropriate and uncomfortable questions when it is not necessary. And then, of course, there is the example of Emily Dye. I'm not sure if you've interviewed her or not, but her story is one where there were concerns due to a teacher behaving inappropriately with her. He had groomed her, and at the time he was fired, had also been touching her inappropriately. According to Emily, around the time of the teacher's firing, she was asked if she had been kissed by him, and that was it, not whether he had touched her. So in some cases, you have very specific questions, and then in other times, such as this one, where there appeared to be a real concern enough to fire the teacher, there were not detailed questions. Later on his controversies page on his blog, Wilson would claim that the teacher was fired for calling Emily Princess on Facebook, and he also claimed that both Emily and the teacher had denied that there was any physical involvement between the two. This is, of course, different than the way Emily remembered the conversation. On his controversies page, Wilson also did say that there was, in fact, a cover-up, but a cover-up conducted by the teacher and Emily. That is the victim in the situation. There is also a good deal of debate about the case being reported to the local police. There was no report filed at the time of the teacher's firing. Only years later, after Emily disclosed details of what had happened to her, then a report was made to the local police. But in the time in between, the abuse continued. Emily has written how she starved herself, how she was dealing with anorexia, how she was hoping someone, anyone would ask her if she was okay, to the police. And I think that's the ultimate danger here. You have people who come in vulnerable to someone they trust for guidance, and this person may not recognize their own limits. And frequently, and this is across the board, very often in situations like this, you'll have a pastor with knowledge of some sort of abuse who tries to handle things in-house. And in-house is the most dangerous place. It so often means cover up. It means not going to the police. It means not getting license experienced help for somebody who's been through something truly awful. And that right there, no matter how much spiritual authority you think you can claim, you are shirking an astounding amount of responsibility for people you believe you're supposed to be shepherding. And that is something you should be doing. I'm not speaking as a reporter here. I'm speaking as a human being that this is something I just cannot understand.
There are larger questions we'll ask about abuse in evangelical spaces in general. Why these haven't found the light of day up until recently, what's causing this, and more. But what makes this community and this church in particular fertile ground for abuse? That's what I asked Stan Korb next.
So I think part of it is definitely just the flimsiness of being in a position of authority due to celebrity and influence in that way. The evangelical worldview, and Kristen Cobes-Dume talks about this, in so many ways it's built up upon evangelical mass media. It's those consumables that teach you what it means to be an evangelical. And I think that's a piece of it. Because if you admit to a failing within your church, that could chip away at public perception and not only threaten your authority, but also threaten your ability to sell those evangelical consumables. Another big part of this is purity culture, which dictates norms of sexuality and instills in women that if they show even a little bit of skin, a shoulder, a kneecap, that could be sexually tempting to a man. And that men have this aggressive sexual monster just under the surface, and that it's women's responsibility to help shield them from their bodies. So when men are not able to control that monster, when abuse does occur, so often the blame goes to the woman. And usually the man is forgiven. He was tempted. So even if the man who is responsible for the abuse, and really this is a very gendered world, so for now I'm going to talk in terms of a male abuser with a female victim. Even when that happens, because the young woman has this sense of shame and blame. Even when that abuse is reported to a member of the clergy, the survivor is placed in a position of seeking forgiveness when they were the victim of abuse. And because clergy can be seen as so close to God in their eyes, they will do whatever they ask. I'll give an example from outside of Moscow, but that I do think is illustrative. One of the women that I profiled in Disobedient Women, Krista Brown, was an example where her youth pastor was her abuser. And he told her, this is what God wanted. God allowed men to have concubines in the Bible. It was God's will. And when she questioned, he likened her to be the devil. That was Satan. If you're someone who really, really, really wants to be holy in the eyes of God, you will do what your pastor tells you to in that situation. Likewise, in situations where the pastor is himself not the abuser, but is in a trusted position of nearness to God, when the survivor is told, you need to forgive, you should not gossip about what happened, that would be sinful, then the survivor is very inclined to be obedient to the pastor. So in one case, you have a direct abuse of power resulting in sexual assault. But even when the pastor is the authority figure to whom the case is reported, but is not the culprit, there is still that same desperate level of compliance, because to do what your pastor tells you is to do what is right in the eyes of God. All of this, to me, underscores something that is very relevant in Moscow, and that is gender roles. Women are frequently positioned as a helpmeet. They're second in line. Submission to one's husband is taught. And so that idea of submission makes you extremely vulnerable when there is a man in a position where he seeks to be predatory. The other side of shifting from purity culture before marriage is submission once you are in a marriage. And I've seen it a surprising number of times in Moscow. And it's a woman's job to help control the sexual impulses of men once in a marriage. That woman goes from having had to be completely virginal to being completely available. And part of her role as a submissive woman is to engage with her husband in any way he sees fit. He is her head. As Nancy Wilson has written as a metaphor for marital sex, a woman cultivates a beautiful garden, and a man is never trespassing in his own garden. It's a phrasing that smacks of property rights in a disturbing way. And I've talked to an alarming number of women who described sex without consent, rape within their marriages, sex they did not want, but that they submitted to. They were fearful. They were in a relationship where they did not know they could say no, or when they did, it didn't matter anyway. So that is not to say that Douglas Wilson endorses rape. That is not what I'm saying. But that this collection of teachings creates a wraparound system where the responsibility for abuse falls to the victim, whether it's inside marriage or not. And it's extremely dangerous when you have someone in a position of authority, whether it's a pastor or in a marriage or in a family, because respect and trust and belief in the intentions of the man, who's usually the one in this position of authority, can be rather absolute. and the trust and belief in the woman, and really child of any gender, is just not there. That's a question, and I hesitate to use the word ignorance here. I don't mean it that way, but it is a lack of understanding of how trauma works. It takes time to process. When you're living through hell and trying to get to safety, well, for one, the last thing on your mind is talking to a reporter. And especially in many of these cases, there's an effort just to make sure that people living in domestically abusive environments know what they're dealing with is actually abuse. If, for instance, physical discipline is sanctioned by your church, encouraged by your church, you may not understand that as abuse. I've talked to women whose husbands spanked them as a disciplinary measure, and maybe struck them in other ways. That is domestic violence. But they don't know how to qualify it because there's a spiritual cast over it. Or if you're young and your authority figure, your pastor, told you that the physical abuse, the severe spanking that you were enduring was God's will, well, then you don't have the vocabulary to say what it is. So that's what's happening here within this spiritual context.
Maybe you're a skeptic. Maybe you're not. But I wager everyone listening has this thought in the back of their mind, even the most seasoned abuse advocates. Why does it take so long for these stories to come to light? You'll hear from Jean later on, but many of the stories we'll profile during this series took years to come to the surface. Inevitably, there's always the question, what's your angle? Why'd you take so long? What are you trying to gain? Are you trying to get famous by taking down a famous pastor? It's okay to ask these questions. We're dealing with a machine of abuse, and we need to confront our preconceived notions, our ignorance, and our fears. StanCorp, though, offers some help.
Yes. By challenging that, you risk being pushed out, and then you would be facing the loss of your entire church community and perhaps being labeled a Jezebel or temptress or an unruly child. But beyond that, for people just within regular society, surveys show that a victim of childhood sexual abuse typically comes forward with their story at age 52. That's how long it takes. So for people who speak up 5, 10, 15 years later, they're on the early side of the curve. They are processing faster than a lot of other people. 52 is the average age. And often, that's the age when people who become parents have children who reach the age in which they experience that abuse. And it makes them realize, if this happened to my child right now, I would not call what's happening an affair. I would not call the child a temptress. I would understand that this is abuse and help them reframe what happens to them. The book itself does span decades and denominations, and one of the earliest cases in disobedient women was within SBC in the 60s, but the area of focus for me is what happened in the last 15 years or so. Once people had access to the internet, even if they were from a high-control religious environment or really any restrictive environment, from message boards to blogs to social media, they were able to see that what they experienced was not just isolated. It was something other people had experienced too. And when those people put a name on it, they knew what it was. It galvanized people having this new understanding that it wasn't just them. And it wasn't exactly the will of God, but it was a pattern of behavior that you can see in a variety of churches. And that created a path for other voices to rise up and also leave high control religious environments. Well, the book itself is a broad survey. Within Disobedient Women, three chapters are dedicated exclusively to Wilson Christchurch Lucas Moscow. And in that context, I think for some people, Doug Wilson could be seen as a culmination of sorts for other evangelical influencers, such as Bill Gothard, or even, and I'm holding up air quotes here, the theology of someone like Rush Dooney. And when you see this cumulative effect of evangelical celebrity culture, the books, the teachings that build up this worldview, Wilson's like the 2.0 of Gothard. His media empire is so much more polished, and he learned some important lessons on spreading messages that I do think makes him a very interesting figure to write about. But in the lives of people who are under his influence, that scope of his reach makes it even more daunting to escape. So in a lot of ways, Disobedient Women culminates too with Moscow.
Abuse has been the church since the church's conception. Abuse exists in the Catholic Church, the Southern Baptist Convention, the Reformed Church, and many, many, many more contexts. So what makes abuse at Doug Wilson's church and a Doug Wilson-influenced church different?
Yeah, let me think. It was either at the end of 2020 or early 2021. It derailed me. It was in a way unique compared to some of my other stories. Often I've had sources who have already come out publicly online, so they sort of built a bit of comfort talking to reporters. These were people who had never talked to reporters, who had sometimes not told their families or their friends the extent of what they had experienced. They were terrified to even text me. They wanted encrypted apps. They were just so worried about their messages being intercepted by the wrong person. It was just not a level of caution and fear I had dealt with before. And what makes Doug Wilson different is also what does make this situation more sinister. Without taking anything away from those who have experienced abuse in any other context, the ecosystem that has been created in Moscow that perpetuates these stories, silences them, explains them away, also can make those who live there feel uniquely trapped. Among pastoral figures I've reported on, there are a lot of people in positions of self-authority who got there due to charisma or knowing the right person. They don't have a degree in theology. They're not actually someone who's gone through a lengthy ordination process. They do counseling without any therapy background, any education in that field. But what comes out of their mouth, they claim, is guided by God. When the people under the influence of these figures also believe that, there's a huge opportunity for abuse. There's also a resistance to deal with abuse when it is reported. And I believe that part of that is because when you're in a position like this, it's actually very fragile. Though you may be evangelical famous, you don't necessarily have the qualifications, the gravitas that someone else might in a mainline denomination, for instance. And an abuse claim may call into question everything else you've done. Unless you really care about these people, the impulse instead will be to cover it up. And that's something we've seen across the board, that there's fear of losing position, or fear of legal cost, or fear of the insurance going up, whatever it is. A reputational element makes people that have that sort of authoritative celebrity value what keeps them in their position. They are so fragile in that position, it can be terrifying to those leaders to deal with and report what are actually crimes. And so figures like this build a million excuses. They cast the abuse survivors away. That's a commonality across the board. But again, in Moscow, it's this wraparound culture. It's not just that we go to this church or the pastor has influence all over the world. It's where the kids go to school. It's the homeschool curriculum published by a publishing house built by this man. Or my husband listens to Cross Politic. Or my husband goes to Fight, Laugh, Feast conferences. Everyone I know is in this church. And so all of your social capital is invested there and at risk if you dare go against the grain. Within Moscow, there is also this idea of Christchurch or Kirker businesses, and people within the church are happy to spend their money there. So if you do step one toe out of line, you're going to lose your friends, your social network, and likely your business. There is a concern within Moscow that even the real estate property within this community is being strategically bought up by people from within the church. And then when you consider CREC, that this model can keep recapitulating, what we see in Moscow could easily, and in some ways is already happening all across the country.
So the question has to be asked, how on earth does Doug Wilson, Christchurch, Canon Press, New St. Andrews, the CREC, Lagos School, ACCS, everything Doug Wilson does get more popular the more these stories come out? Think about it. When an abuse scandal finds the light of day, it tends to rip the church apart. And while it may take a while, it does something. But in this case, it only seems to make these movements more popular, not less. So I asked Dan Korb the question, how and why does he continue to grow?
Yeah, I think I would push back a little on that. It's not always the people step down. There are plenty of cases where the pastor, for example, Andy Savage, after the allegations of an assault back when he was a youth pastor in Texas, when those came out online, Savage confessed in front of his church, and they gave him a standing ovation. There's a restoration process that is baked into many evangelical communities. Even Robert Morris, who recently stepped down from Gateway Church after newly resurfaced allegations that in 1982 he had abused a girl when she was 12. When that story first came up at the church, he stepped away for 2 years, and the other pastors, as they say, poured into him to restore him, not into his victim. There is a path forward, and very frequently the focus goes on to the leader, not to the victim or survivor. Now, Wilson is different. We're not dealing with someone who himself is facing allegations of abuse. Instead, this is a situation where a large number of people from within his church ecosystem, school ecosystem, broader church denominational networks talk about abuse that has been normalized with his theology, or they say their abuses were known about by him or other leaders within the church, but mishandled. I will say I don't know many other pastors who have a page on their website dedicated to their many controversies. And I think in his case, he's been able to point to those controversies in an advantageous way. It gives him an opportunity to both wave off personal responsibility, but it speaks to a crowd that enjoys being part of a culture war. It lets him both frame himself as having been persecuted, but also in a confrontational way, go back on the attack. This is a pastor who wants to be like a flamethrower in the world. There is this antagonistic machismo that people seem to enjoy. And not to jump too far into politics, but I do see a similar situation with Donald Trump. The more allegations he have floated his way, the more his supporters seem to step in line and kind of feed on it. They feed on the worry and the fear and the moral questions of the other side. And there's almost a militaristic alignment. I have my side and we're going to stand by our guy. Moreover, having all of these media entities does seem to enslave Wilson in a way and does allow his worldview to insulate the people who follow him. It creates an echo chamber where once people decide they're in alignment with Wilson, they can, you know, listen to the podcast, watch the videos, read the books, gobble up this world, and feel like he's given them an explanation for how the world works. And as those people endow him with trust, I suspect that whether or not it makes it palatable to look the other way from the cases of abuse that have been reported, at least makes it doable. It makes it seem as if he's being maligned for his politics or his position within a culture war, as if cases of reported mishandling of abuse are some means to an end by a secular culture to create a headache for Mr. Wilson, rather than actual cases of abuse that have been mishandled and that victims are crying out for help. And here's where my other reporting is informative. Within the Southern Baptist Convention, for example, we now have decades of documented sexual abuse and mishandling of that abuse. Yet, even with that enormous scale, there are still plenty of true believers who will say, well, it's not that bad. They don't want to believe it. They don't want to believe the people they trust to cover things up or do not behave the way they wish they would. And it's difficult if you are a person following evidence of abuse within any situation like this and seeing people deny, 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 or ignore, ignore, ignore. But that is, in fact, what many survivors are greeted with.
Now, to the article that put these abuse stories on the map and of the wider evangelical conscience. Why would Vice be interested in the story of a small town in Idaho? How does a secular agnostic like Stancorp go from writing a small article to a major book on this movement? Stancorp describes the process of writing the article and then expanding this to her 2023 book, Disobedient Woman.
So I am a freelance reporter. I go where the stories are, and I've written for plenty of other national publications. I never received a response like I did for that Vice article. People still occasionally email me. People who formerly lived in Moscow, people from other CREC churches, people whose friends left, people who wish they could leave. It's overwhelming. Yeah, and no, I get, you know, response letters, a handful of emails after an article, but not like that. And it did not stop. So there was a wave at the beginning, but I will still get messages occasionally from people who just found the article or someone who wants me to tell their story, or I've gotten DMs from people asking, do you know anyone you trust in Moscow? My female relative married into a family there, and I cannot tell from her Facebook posts if she's safe. Do you know any way to get a message to someone trustworthy there to see if she's safe? Like, I don't typically get that from other stories. Now, as for writing the book, it helped me understand, in a way, why these stories of abuse surfaced as they have, and why they're so numerous. And certainly part of that is the internet gave people the opportunity to come forward. But also see that within evangelicalism, these positions of authority that certain pastors are in create a lot of impetus to keep these things quiet, keep them hushed up. The stories that women told me from Christchurch were stories of women's submission in dominion within families within a church, in a church that wants dominion over a geographic area. As we moved through 2020 and 2021, and I began reporting more on Christian nationalism, that thirst for dominion became very clear, that this isn't only a women's issue. This is a national issue built on the backs of women. And I think women can be sentinels for the danger of a movement like this, because they can show what it's like to live under this sort of expansive control. When you're in a system like this, women are the proof test. If you can operate within a community and tell more than half the people, you must be submissive. Here's why. This is what God wants. They will behave that way, even when they are enduring horrible things. You've shown that this quest to hold dominion over a majority of other people can work. And to me, that's why it's extremely vital that we look at this and see how in a system like this, with what feel like so few ways out, these women who have stepped forward are so courageous. They're breaking through the weight of what they've dealt with within their own lives, but they're also carrying a warning for everyone else. And to me, that's how this grew from just one story.
She couldn't not write the book. The response to her article impressed it on her. The volume of emails means she was on to something. You've followed the story of this series, profiling all the movements associated with Doug Wilson, Christian nationalism, patriarchy, and so much more. And you might have seen their response to other outlets like ours. They like threatening suit. But what was the response of both the article and the book, both from those who harbor abusers and those who've experienced abuse?
Honestly, I think if I were perceived as an insider, if I were someone from within the church, it would have been brutal. But I think it's easier to wave off a unchurched journalist, feminist woman. I expected an explosion, and I didn't really get one. But I did gain a number of people on my social media who resonated with the story, who have stories like those that I've been telling. And it breaks my heart every time I see it. There is something I included at the end of the book. There was a woman whose detailed story I ended up not including for custody reasons that she's still dealing with. But during one of her talks, she asked me, are you the chosen one? Because in her church, they're still waiting for a reporter to blow it all up. And I just thought, that's so profoundly dangerous. She so desperately needed someone to believe in. And I just felt like you should not be putting that much trust in anyone after what you've gone through and are still going through. That scares me a little bit. It's this big, huge, hungry trust. And I am the recipient of it and hold it, knowing how that kind of absolute trust has already been betrayed over and over within the church. It's a very painful balance to hold. I do want to respond just a little to what you're saying, what the church should be. I grew up in the church. I was a very faithful kid, and I thought for a little bit there I was supposed to be a minister. Like, I was in it. Then my faith broke, and now I'm this person outside of the church who spends basically every day thinking about how can the church save itself from all of this? How can churches be better? How can leaders be better and fulfill the promise that meant so much to me as a little kid, that means so much to so many people across this country, whether people are no longer able to believe due to what they've seen. It's a very weird kind of lonely position to be in, caring so much about a thing that isn't my home anymore, but that I know is a vital place for a lot of people.
With all these stories, articles, and books that have profiled abuse in these circles, what happens to the women who tell their stories? For those who shared their story with us throughout this series, and for you who might be listening who has one of your own, what kind of consequences have you faced? What kind of consequences do you face? What kind of consequences will you face? Maybe you don't have a story of abuse. So put yourself in an abuse survivor's shoes and ask, what's it like? What happens when I speak out? Stan Korb answers.
Usually they are not believed. And if they are believed, they are treated as if it's their fault. The title Disobedient Women is tongue-in-cheek because so many of these people I've interviewed have been treated as if they're being disobedient or defiant, that they're gossiping by telling the truth. Their quote-unquote gossip is treated with the same severity of as sin as what happened to them. Some of my sources have been doxxed. They are harassed and harassed online. They have professional consequences due to that harassment. Their lives can be ruined. These are people often trying to get out of abusive relationships who, when they turn to the church sides with their husband. They may lose custody of their children, which are the people they're actually trying to protect. That's what's motivating them to come forward more times than not. It is desperately terrifying to speak the truth in a system that does not want you to, in a system that tells you it is more holy for you to submit and endure. More often than not, survivors are treated as a danger that needs to be knocked down as quickly and efficiently as possible. I have interviewed sources who say, and this is not just one, this is not just a few, this is many, many, many people who have told me this, that the initial abuse was hard enough. it was a trauma they will carry for the rest of their lives. But the response from the church was tenfold what the initial abuse did to them, because they were scared, because they needed help, because they took one last chance and trusted the people who told them they stood in the place of Jesus Christ in their lives, that that person would act like they hoped Jesus would act. And instead, they weaponized their vulnerability and tried to grind them into the ground.
With that, I ask Stan Korb for any concluding thoughts.
I have a lot of things to say. I guess I'll start by saying this is not only happening in Moscow. There are a lot of copycats who want to rise up and be this influential. Joel Webin comes to mind. There are others building similar churches, trying to start their own little mini denominations, local fiefdoms. And if you're swept into that, or it's in your town, or if it's in your town and you're not swept into it, I think it's important to just be a sounding board for your friends. They may one day need a door out. And I think it's difficult to imagine leaving an abusive environment, let alone considering what it may feel like, be like, to take your understanding of the world apart piece by piece and really interrogating what you've believed, especially for the people who may be responsible for doing harm that was justified within that sort of system. I know it's hard to deconstruct that sort of sick theology that gave you that amount of power, but it's what the people in your life deserve. I recently met a woman named Margaret, who's known as the deconstruction doula. There are other communities of people online, Ed Wham, who I've written about examining, Doug Wilson in Moscow. They help connect people to resources, even just simple things like online quizzes where you can determine whether what you're experiencing is domestic abuse. For a lot of people, they just don't have the words for what's going on, and having the vocabulary can change a life. It takes a lot of courage to figure your next steps out, to feel okay being independent of a religious community that was your whole world. But making those steps, especially for people who have children, letting them live a life where they are safe, I think it's worth making those steps. And hopefully your spouse takes those steps with you. I know it is all so big and scary. And really, if there is a God, I just cannot imagine God wants people to live in pain and fear. I certainly don't hope so.
If you have a story like one of those Sarah has written about, please know you're not alone. Know we care about you, and many others do as well. Reach out to us. Find out how to do so in our show notes, but do so safely, especially if you're still in an environment like the movements we're profiling. There really is help out there for you, and we'll help you find it. Next week, in part two, we begin profiling the survivors. They are no longer silent. Sons of Patriarchy is brought to you by the administrators of Examining Doug Wilson in Moscow in partnership with Peter Bell. It's written, produced, and edited by Peter Bell. Original music, sound design, and mixing by Aaron Feeney. This series wouldn't be possible without the dozens of abuse survivors whose bravery and vulnerability make it what it is. Every episode was sent to them before being published, and their feedback, edits, encouragement, and eventual approval make this what it is. May your voices be heard far and wide. Thank you.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.